Good morning. Let's travel back in time 1 week.
This was what I heard this morning at 5:20 as I walked out the front door. It was so beautiful that I ran straight back inside, grabbed the tape recorder and recorded this.
The sun greeted Philip on Countrywide a week ago.
I was thinking that the weather has been such a drudgery and the cause of so much anxiety in the course of the last few months. And I don't know if we are out of the woods by any means, but when a morning like this one comes along, you just take it.
Indeed you do, Philip. And two more people that took it the very next day. John Milan and Porrig Lodge in Ennis for Clare versus Limerick.
Thank you, Marie. 274 days after lifting the Liam McCarthy Cup, Limerick's drive for five is beginning today in the claustrophobic noise box of Cusack Park under a glorious blue sky. Buskers, hawkers and loudhailers around Ennis earlier on. Traffic building up from 10 a.m. and they were queuing outside the turnstiles from 11 a.m.
After months of meteorological misery, John Milan was raring to go.
Oh, Porrick, the bannerman, it should have been Soren Goal, Dave O'Reilly. Should have put it to the back of the net, cracking save.
Of course, we may have to send the credit to an unexpected weather person.
Rachel English promises in Morning Ireland on Friday it would be T-shirt weather in Ennis on Sunday, and that's the way it's developed.
But no sooner had Sunday turned to Monday than the Copernicus report was preoccupying George Lee.
Oh my God, it's happening before our very eyes and it is really, really challenging. You know, in our own country, we are very much aware about the poor weather we had
the
last
rain.
Year and all the rain.
And
which
more
seems
rain.
Gone forever.
And more rain, yeah.
And so you kind of get obsessed with that. But when you stand back and you look at what's happening to the continent as a whole, you get a different perspective because you see that Europe is the fastest warming continent on Earth. And the Arctic is by far warming faster than anywhere else. So that has impacted on the average increase in temperatures in Europe. The second is that in terms of latitude, compared to somewhere similar with the same latitude in America, we're much warmer, so we tend to be warmer.
Later on Monday, however, the sun was still being greeted by Oliver Callan.
Delighted to report that it is a dry, bright day all around the country this morning. It was very, very sunny in Dublin earlier, but it's clouding over now. But that's fine. It's just not going to rain. And it is going to remain mainly dry right through the week. There is a warning, however, outbreak of premature shorts wearing by some people and outdoor dining, I saw over the weekend as well, in those wincing northeast winds. Fair play to them, but they'll be on the Lemsip by lunchtime today. I've seen sandals actually already, which is a disgrace, by the way, out there. If you're wearing sandals, shame on you. Irish toes should never, ever be seen. Not before the end of August, maybe.
I'll have to plead guilty to the shorts, but the sandals haven't made an appearance just yet. One item that made an appearance very early in the week was farm machinery. Here's Eddie Doyle, a potato man from Kilkenny, speaking with Clare on Wednesday.
Mother Nature has come good and we're up and running like you'd need an army to get everything done as quick as we'd like to get done in our heads. But It's just adequate for work, and obviously we work the drier fields first, which is what we're at. And, you know, the heavier land is probably just becoming workable at present. At the weekend, I had great help. I had lads off from college and school and chaps that helped me regularly. But we had everything moving and it was mighty, you know.
And it was like that all over the country. Machines were everywhere. There was takeaways in Tipperary being delivered to tractors. But by Wednesday lunchtime, Shea Byrne, sitting in for Louise Duffy, almost put a damper on things.
It was kind of a little bit overcast this morning when I was coming in. And then I went back out about 15 minutes ago to have a breath of fresh air. And it was drizzling rain. It's like, ah, lads, come on. What's going on?
Shea Byrne there on Wednesday. The week was largely dominated by two stories of tragedies some four decades apart. Here's Taoiseach Simon Harris speaking in the Dáil on Tuesday.
I know there have been many, many times when you thought this day would never come.
Tuesday marked the day of an official state apology to the families and victims of the Stardust disaster in 1981.
I am deeply sorry that you were made to fight for so long that they went to their graves never knowing the truth. Today we say formally, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us the most. We should have stood with you, but instead we forced you to stand against us. 48 young people lost their lives in the Stardust disaster. The families gathered here today and their loved ones who perished and all those who suffered horrific injuries were the victims of a mass tragedy. It is to our great and eternal shame that far from the warm embrace of a caring state, the Stardust family has experienced a cold shoulder, a deaf ear, and two generations of struggle for truth and justice. I am so deeply sorry that your first bid for justice ended with suspicion being cast on those who had died or survived on that catastrophic night. For all of this, as Taoiseach, on behalf of this state, I apologise unreservedly. I say today clearly in Dáil Éireann, every person there was innocent.
Taoiseach Simon Harris speaking in the Dáil on Tuesday. Moments later, Joe Duffy got some instant reaction from people who had lived with this tragedy for four decades.
I suppose, Joe, I was saying that we've reached where we wanted to be. And I bought 49 red roses, actually.
Well done.
Because I bought one for the unborn child was killed in the Stardust as well. And I will say that I'm very, very honoured to be here. I'm very honoured to be inside the chamber. And I'm very honoured to be here to hear of the victorious moment. I'm absolutely full of joy and of relief, Joe. Yeah. I'm very, very relieved today.
You were only a baby in a cot when...
I know, being the Stardust baby, it's come with a lot of difficulty, I may say, but it's also come with a lot of honour. And I'm honoured today, and they're vindicated, and I'm very, very happy.
It had taken 43 years of hail, rain and snow for the women and fathers and family of the victims that were unlawfully killed.
Yeah.
They were 48 children of this nation, a very nation that the government turns their back on until today.
Joe spoke to Rosemary, who had just landed in Dublin to start a nursing career earlier that week.
One of my first shifts actually in Dublin was in the Mater looking after two patients that had been moved out of ICU, probably to make space for more critically ill patients, say, from the Stardust fire. So I suppose I found that a bit daunting as a
You arrived in Dublin to begin your work on the weekend of the Stardust.
Maybe the Thursday or the Friday, and I'd registered with this agency, and say the hospital then brought in, I suppose, agency nurses to cope with the extra demands, and I was looking after these two gentlemen, but. Later on then, I suppose I was staying up around Phibsborough and St. Peter's Road there, an accommodation. And I suppose a lot of the shifts then were in the Mater because it was so local to me. And then in April and May then I specialed Jimmy Fitzpatrick. I know he's been on TV and radio quite a lot over the years.
Okay, well tell us about, because Jimmy was one of your patients, that's what you're saying.
He was, I was looking after him in an isolation room, one-to-one nursing because of his needs really, due to his burns on his hands and arms mainly. And so obviously he wasn't able to do anything for himself. So I spent those, my shifts, any other shifts that I was working was with him.
And Rosemary remembers Jimmy's parents.
I think they both worked in Cadbury's.
Yeah, that's a lot of people parents, there in the area, yeah.
Yeah, and my birthday fell in May, and I remember they coming in with the biggest box of Cadbury's chocolates they'd ever seen for me, And he often had visitors coming in, and they were all the young people that were survivors of the fire, and they all spoke with husky voices due to the smoke damage. And it was quite emotional really listening to it, but I thought he did a good job, and I thought it was quite thorough.
And you were thinking of Jimmy, obviously.
I was thinking of Jimmy, and I'm sure he was probably there, but
Were you there, Jimmy?
I was indeed. How are you, Rosemary?
I have a photograph of you, and you had lovely blonde wavy hair and sitting there in the hospital room. I didn't recognise you when I first saw you on television. Yeah. You've none of that hair left.
No, that's your wave goodbye to my head.
And Jimmy, do you remember Rosemary?
I most certainly do. I do indeed. Yeah, she was absolutely amazing, I have to say. I remember we had so many great laughs, and she was always keeping me in good form, and she was always attentive to me, and she was just amazing. And I'd look forward to her coming in because we'd have a great bit of fun together, and because I knew I was going to be taken so well care of, and indeed I was. I actually got into the foyer into the hallway, and I was about 3 foot from the door, which I was almost out. But on the way out, I passed two friends that were screaming and going nowhere, so I kind of ran back to get them and throw them into the hallway, because everybody was starting to panic and pushed away into the same place. I then fell. People are running across my back. I can't get up. When I fell, I'm facing the door. But when I crawled to the left, I realised I'm going the wrong way because I'm on a wooden floor. I knew I was back on the dance floor. I jumped up again, got another gust of thick black smoke, which could absolutely chew. And I was born, and so I fell again to the ground. But this time, I could breathe on the ground because there's about 6 inches of air down there.
Okay.
And I just, the best way to describe it would be like crawling, like an army crawl on your arms.
Yeah.
So that's all I could do, was just keep crawling till I was bumping into things all the time, but there was still falling all on top of us. And then I got to a doorway that people were kicking, and I jumped up and just kept kicking with them, and we all fell out the exit.
Thick black smoke you could absolutely chew. There's a phrase to conjure with. Joe also asked Jimmy when he had heard about the friends that he had lost.
I was sitting with David Morton's brother yesterday, Alan, who I hadn't seen up to now since the fire.
Okay.
And we were chatting, and David was a great friend of mine, and we were chatting away, and I was saying to him, I was in Stephen's Hospital, and I was like mummified because I was bandaged head to toe, and there was a young guy, a young child beside us. I'd say he was about 12. He was obviously having a graft to his arm. But the Stardust came on the television, and he said to me, my neighbour died in that. Your neighbour? And he goes, yeah. I said, what's your neighbour's name? And he went, David Morton. And that's how I found out about David. My mum and dad were going to funerals, changing their clothes and coming back up to me, because they would go to my friend's funerals and then come up to see me in hospital. And he never told me he couldn't, like, you know, it was in a bad way. And then the lovely Rosemary and all the angels that looked after us. When I was sitting in the ward one day, there was another physiotherapist came in, and she said, how are you getting up? How are you keeping? And she says, great. And I said, do you know anything about Liam, my friend Liam Dunn? And she went, oh, Liam was a lovely guy. And I went, what do you mean, was a lovely guy? How do you mean? And she said, oh, I said, is he still home? Is he gone home or in the hospital? And she said, oh, I don't know. I'll have to check it. She couldn't break the news to me then. And then when Mum and Dad came up, they came in to see me crying, they realised. Then they had to tell me about the rest of them, because, like, it was just, people were not telling me. So that was, I think it was about April or May when I started hearing the news.
Well, we haven't heard anything about redress, and that is the last thing on our mind at the moment, because this was never about money. And if they are talking about that, like, you know, about the, what they gave to the parents of the deceased victims, $7,500 per child. My mother and father would have got $7,500 for Mary and $7,500 for Martina. And when my father went to the compensation scheme, the ex gratia compensation scheme set up under Judge Barrington, and he stood in front of that judge and told the judge that the Stardust had affected him insofar as that he has taken to alcohol and it's caused him a lot of stress mentally and physically. He's emotionally upset. And the judge said that he wasn't entitled to any compensation because the man didn't suffer grief. So my father was declined.
Antoinette Keegan of the Stardust Relatives speaking about her father. Compensation is hardly imaginable for something so tragic. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Brian Lally sitting in for Sinead Mooney this morning. The Ray D'Arcy studio this week was awash with megastars. On Tuesday, Daniel O'Donnell and Ray were chatting about Elvis Presley. And then the conversation turned to the approximate number of songs that Daniel had recorded in his career.
Must be, I suppose, about 500, I would imagine. actually, somebody came up, and I should remember this, because again, as an Elvis, I can't stop
falling in love with you. Yeah.
So a request came in Australia for the song, and I just said to Kieran, who's the MD, I says, I never recorded that. And he just played it. He says, that's you singing it there. So I thought,
that's
definitely a senior moment. And I had only recorded it like 2 or 3 years ago. So I should have remembered. Well, then we went out that night and I sung it.
Yeah.
So I,
muscle memory, whatever.
I knew it. Yeah.
Daniel O'Donnell there on Tuesday with Ray. Daniel, of course, is famous the world over for being a nice guy. Another guest of Ray's is famous the world over for acting as not nice guys. Jeremy Irons told Ray about the joys of playing the baddie.
you know, from Shakespeare into movies, it's the same. Richard III, you know, all the Shakespeare baddies are a lot of fun to play. I don't know why. I mean, I haven't played all baddies.
No,
I
can't play, no.
But I do, whether it's my face or how people think of me, or maybe they think I'm a baddie, I don't know. But I certainly have more fun doing that. The greatest part of the relationship is getting to know them, getting to find out what makes them tick. I like to do that with a character. I like to make him, make the audience think, is he good? Is he bad? What are you going to do now? It makes them watch. It makes them become interested. And I hope it makes them feel that, well, this character's a bit like me, because some days I'm like that, some days I'm like that.
Jeremy Irons there on the good parts of being the baddie. Back in Oliver's studio, playwright and columnist Hilary Fannin spoke about her twin diagnoses of ovarian cancer and lymphoma.
You know, my three siblings have also had cancer, and I've seen them going through it.
Really?
And having different reactions to their chemo, you know, and their treatments. Between the four of us, we've done six cancers now.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, you know that scene in Jaws where they sit around and they compare scars? It's a bit like that around my kitchen table.
A good writer's response.
Yeah, it's
but they're all
funny.
Still here.
They're all, they all got through it, the whole lot of them, yeah.
Hilary also spoke to Oliver about getting an update on her cancer, which turned out to be just the sort of downgrade you'd love.
My cancer was downgraded from 3 to 1C.
The cruelty of this little level of numbers, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really funny. But as the consultant said, he rarely gets to give that kind of news to people.
Right.
So I was very lucky in a way. The lymphoma possibly led them, because that was what was kind of causing the problems that led me, got me into A&E. I think it was in the investigations of that that let them find the ovarian cancer before it had spread.
Incredible.
Mm.
Hilary's adaptation of Gorky's Children of the Sun is currently running in the Abbey Theatre. One of the characters has an extremely telling line of dialogue.
There is just the beautiful now to cradle our failures. And the beautiful now, it is magnificent.
Mm. And I suppose particularly magnificent when you think of what playwright Hilary Fannin has faced. She was speaking with Oliver Callan. In the Darcy studio, another megastar exploded onto the line. Ruby Wax. They talked about good and bad interviews, and a certain Donald Trump tops her list.
Well, it was the worst interview I've ever done.
All right.
But television is, you know, can be, they can't distinguish. They just think, I'm being audacious. I was being a jerk. It wasn't a good interview. It didn't matter. It was Donald Trump, and he deserves no publicity at all.
Yeah.
I don't think we should breathe his name.
Okay, we'll move on. We move on. So of all the people you met, and it's a long list, who stood out for you?
Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
I mean, I got on the tap shoes and made sure she loved me by the end of that interview. And she did.
Mm.
You know, and so my whole show was just worth becoming her friend for 35 years.
Ruby Wax there, speaking with Ray Darcy. Now to the second of those two tragedies that have dominated the airwaves this week. The inquest into Aoife Johnston's death at University Hospital Limerick just before Christmas 2022. John Cook was reporting from the coroner's court in Kilmallock all week. Firstly, some of the evidence of Aoife's parents.
As there was no trolley available, her father, James, tried to make a bed for her with two chairs in a room he likened to a storage area for PPE and personal protective equipment. A picture of Aoife on the two chairs was presented to the coroner. He said Aoife's skin became blotchy. She had a mark on her left eye like a birthmark. She was vomiting violently, he outlined. I continually begged for help, he said. The response was a cup for Aoife to get sick into and a rebuke on one occasion from a staff member, he said, telling him the staff member was well aware that Aoife was sick, but I have 70 other patients to look after. Aoife was screaming in agony with pain, he said, in further distressing evidence. In her right leg and head, he also heard other people on trolleys in the emergency department asking nurses and doctors to intervene and help her. Both of Aoife's parents said she was brought alone for an X-ray in the early hours of the morning. They were told they weren't required to come when they asked if they could. They said that when she returned, she said Aoife told them that staff had been giving out to her because she couldn't stand up any longer. At 6 a.m, over 12 hours after triage, James Johnston said his daughter was finally seen by a doctor in agony with pain in her head, with blotchy skin vomiting, and we were told she would be treated as if she had meningitis. James said he went out roaring at the nurses to help. His wife Carol outlining how Aoife could no longer communicate. As one staff member told Aoife, "If you don't tell me what's wrong with you, how can I know?" Aoife was then taken to the resuscitation area of the emergency department. She was later moved to the ICU, and following scans, James and Carol were advised nothing could be done to save their daughter. The Johnstons and their daughters, along with members of their extended family, wept as they refuted suggestions that Aoife's condition might have shown some signs of improvement at times. She was getting worse and worse, according to James, sicker and sicker, and I kept begging for help.
Over the next few days, there was traumatic evidence from the medics involved.
Catherine Skelly, who was a clinical nurse manager on the night in question, said emergency department overcrowding conditions that night were critical and unsafe. With 15 nurses on duty, she said there should have been 20. We could have done with 30, she added, due to the volume of patients. It was akin to a war zone, she said. Trolleys back to back, patients lined up on chairs, some sitting on floors, obstructing toilets, sick children being held in parents' arms. Should have been a major response situation, in my opinion, she added, outlining how she had contacted her nursing superiors and they had raised calls further up the line of management saying they needed help. Category 2 patients, like Aoife Johnston, she said, need to be seen within 10 to 15 minutes as per their triage protocol, but it was taking over 10 hours for some of those patients. She said her assistant director of nursing called the executive manager on duty while she spoke to the consultant in charge of the emergency department. He said he'd been in earlier that day and would return the following morning. Triage nurse Ariana de Guzman says she triaged Aoife Johnston at 7:14 p.m. and classified her as a category 2 patient due to the sepsis query. She said Aoife should have been moved to the resus department to begin sepsis treatment, but they were already at more than double the capacity, she said. Emergency department nurse Kira McCarthy is not present for this inquest. She's out of the country, we heard. But in her written statement, she noted excessively high emergency department waiting times on the night in question. At 8 a.m, nurse McCarthy said she found Aoife distressed, tearful and agitated. She approached one of the emergency department registrars again, she said, and told the doctor she needed to be reassessed. Aoife became unresponsive, she said, and of her own accord, the nurse said she asked two other nurses help her immediately remove Aoife to the resus area at that stage. Dr. Mohammed Hassan said he regards her death as a black point in our history and my memory. Every time there's a crisis in the hospital, I think of Aoife Johnston.
It was a week of extremely difficult testimony, and on Thursday afternoon, the coroner, John McNamara, gave his verdict.
John McNamara, the Limerick coroner, acknowledged the very difficult evidence for the family throughout 4 days this week and the deep upset caused for them. He said the only verdict he could record was a verdict of death by medical misadventure. And counsel for University of Limerick Hospital and the HSE, Conor Halpin, said he would not oppose this verdict of death by misadventure, as he reiterated apologies to the Johnston family and condolences on the loss of their daughter Aoife.
Solicitor for the Johnston family, Damien Tansey, spoke to reporters outside the court.
She had no chance. By the time the correct treatment was administered, the following morning, it was too late. And you heard Dr. Gray today, the casualty consultant, say that at 7:15, she was treated very well, but unfortunately, it was too late. You heard Dr. Stapleton, consultant in microbiology yesterday, say that all of the pathogens that were discovered were all amenable to the ordinary antibiotics. So had she received the appropriate treatment in a timely manner, we wouldn't be here today, and that is an enormous tragedy.
Aoife Johnston's parents, James and Carol, also spoke to the media.
We went to the hospital, really. The only thing I can say is we went there to get help and we didn't receive it, so it's clear as day what happened this week. Like.
Yeah. We arrived on the 17th and we never thought on the 19th we'd be leaving without Aoife. Aoife had, in my words, is a horrible death. So,
horrible death, yeah.
She suffered the whole night and we brought Aoife where we told her she would be looked after, but she wasn't. We told her she was in the best place.
Try and get some rest, Aoife.
Get some rest.
You're in the best place.
The doctors will be here soon and the doctors never came.
We also heard from Aoife Johnston's sisters, Megan and Karen.
It kills me all the time. I never got to say goodbye to her. When I got that call, Aoife was already gone. I can't. I never got to see my sister and complete her leaving, sir. I never got to see my sister do her graduation. I never got to see my sister moving on to the next chapter with her boyfriend over there. That Aoife's boyfriend left heartbroken. Even when I knew Aoife was in hospital, like, I thought she was going to be okay. And then the next morning to get a call that she's in ICU, I didn't know what to do. And we never get to see her again. Oh, but I'm just so grateful. With this beautiful girl, like, she was just a beautiful girl inside and out. She was just an amazing person, and I'll cherish the memories of her forever and ever.
That's Aoife Johnston's sister, Megan, speaking outside the coroner's court in Kilmallock on Thursday. A different sort of struggle now for Michael Hennessy and Leona Tuck. They were the stars of Sunday's episode of Last One on the Train. They're an inter-abled couple, and they met in that hotbed of romance, Quinn's Pub in Drumcondra.
My friend had texted me saying, you know, I've missed your birthday, which was a few days prior. Would you hop off the bus and join me for a beer in Quinn's? And I hopped off the 16 in Drumcondra. And as I walked in, Michael was wheeling out. So in that kind of long corridor, he caught my eye straight away. I went to go right to move out of his way to let him through, but he went right as well. And then I went left. So it was this game of chicken that actually lasted a few times, and it went on in my head for so long I had to stop and put my hand on his shoulder and say, I'm so sorry, you go left and I'll go right. And we laughed. I just remember thinking, he is beautiful.
Maybe she mightn't like me saying this, but it was the day Wexford were playing Dublin in the Leinster football final, and it was a game we definitely should have won. We lost by an OG. One of my friends said, oh, sure, look, there's no point going back to Wexford now. So we stayed, booked the room in Coppers, and stayed in Quinn's. That, even though Wexford lost, it was probably the best day I've ever had.
They're an outdoors couple that do a lot of advocating for access, but it still rankles the way that folks often talk to her about him while he's there.
This woman was talking to me the whole time and not Mick. And she actually was asking me about Michael's clip-on motor, which is the electric wheel for his wheelchair. And Mick was just looking up, and then I realised halfway through it that she was talking to me about Mick's device and not Mick. I think it's the assumption that I'd order for Michael. So I would often order from a menu and then hand the menu straight back to the waiter and then just go on my phone. I know he's still waiting for me to say, and he'll have, but Mick will then, you know. So you develop your own way of dealing with that.
Leona Tuck there. And Last One on the Train, the clue is in the title, is on RT Radio 1 on Sunday evenings. Over on Lyric FM, there was much rejoicing when it emerged that when she's not counting her Manola Blahnik shoes, Sarah Jessica Parker is an avid listener.
Sarah Jessica Parker posted online and she said how kind of about Lyric, that she listens to Lyric, but all the comments on this Instagram post is everybody saying how fantastic Marty Whelan is and that he should stay awake because Marty Whelan is our national treasure.
Well, that was me. I was up all night doing that.
Marty Whelan and Orla Woods there rejoicing in the listening habits of Sarah Jessica Parker. We'll be back with part three right after this. And you're welcome back. Now, if Bord Fáilte are looking for tourism ambassadors, they could do well to listen to this. Here's Cindy from Canada.
We rented a car and we got on the road and went down for an hour. And a light came on that said the electrical system was failing, basically.
So they're on a roundabout with an alternator problem, so they can't charge their phones and they can't get in touch with the B&B that they're supposed to be staying in. This is Billy from the B&B.
The car was going to be taken away and they were going to be left on the side of the road with their suitcases, which I found fairly unbelievable way to treat tourists in this country.
Eamon, how are you? You came upon Cindy and Daniel at the side of the road.
Next to speak to Katie was Eamon, the archetypal Good Samaritan.
I was skipping home. I was at a meeting and I was just going home and taking my exit, and I see this car pulled in at the side of the road in the wrong way, and I said, this isn't right, there's something happening. So I pulled in, Cindy and Dan were out of the car, so I said, can I help you in any way? And they said, our phones are dying, we're trying to get in touch with different people. I said, look, just charge the phones in my car there, I'll stay with you for a few minutes and we'll see where it goes from there. They eventually got through to the rental company. The rental company said, you know, we won't be able to help you for at least couple of hours.
So Eamon arrived home to his lady wife Catherine with Dan and Cindy in tow.
I walked in the door and I said, Catherine, I've another couple of strays here for you. And she kind of just said, ah, yeah. Yeah, Catherine's brilliant. She's very, very hospitable, I would say. So it was just, come on in, have a cup of tea. Would you like a sandwich and whatever? And within, I suppose, maybe a quarter of an hour, the AA did ring and said, we'll be there in 5 minutes. So I just said to Cindy, you stay where you are. We'll go back up to the car and we'll meet that man. That was fine. We did that. And unfortunately, the AA man couldn't get the car going.
So what Eamon and Catherine thought would be a cup of tea and a sandwich turned out to be an offer of accommodation.
We couldn't get a car sorted for them. We could get nothing, probably 11 o'clock at this stage or 10:30, and the offices were closed and we couldn't get a car. They kind of said, oh, we'll find a hotel, and we're close here where we are in Laois to the Heritage Hotel. And Catherine kind of walked past me, caught me eye and kind of called me over and said, sure, they can stay here. The lads are in college and two of the lads are away. So I just said, ah, sure, I suppose, yeah. So we asked them would they like to stay, and of course, oh God, no, we couldn't impose on you and everything. And I said, you're not imposing really. You're just getting a bed for the night, and we'll get you sorted in the morning. So that's what happened. They stayed with us for the night.
And it all ended happily ever after, and you can listen back to Thursday's Liveline to get the gory details on the story. One of Oliver Callan's guests during the week was Ger Redmond, a man, as they say, with a past. He grew up in Dublin, and as a young fella, got involved in crime. Oliver asked him, how do you join a gang?
You basically become a runner first. So you're bringing stuff around for them, doing the odd jobs, you know, trying to gain that trust. And then you move up the ladder pretty quick. I was very aggressive as a young kid. I was venting all that negativity on people. I didn't trust anyone. I gave up trusting people. Couldn't trust adults particularly because I seen all adults as my mother and father. So I had a vengeance towards them.
He remembered the first day he went to prison.
It was disheartening. Do you know what? I sat down in the prison cell and I remember sitting there crying. And I wasn't crying because I was afraid. I was crying because when my father got locked up, I cursed him. And here's me doing the exact same thing. And that's what happens in a generation. Yeah. And I had 4 kids at this stage. And I was like, look, what you've just done the exact same thing. You're a hypocrite. So that was a realisation for me. That was the start of that realisation of, like, you've just done what your father has done.
Who you were angry with.
Yeah. I'm not going to get jobs. I'm going to have this stigma when I get out. He was locked up. He's a scumbag.
So what happens when you get out?
So when I get out, then go back to the gang. And I went back to the gang, start making money again. I got married in 2016 to my wife, Pauline. And then my son was due in October 2016, Ross. And when he was born, something went off in me. Like, I just said, you know what? I'm going to be his hero. And I didn't know which way I was going to do it. But I just said, I'm going to stop being in this gang. I'm going to change my generation. I'm going to change what I'm doing. I'm going to get a normal job. And I'm going to lead him into a better life.
And that's exactly what Ger Redmond did. But before we leave Ger, here's what I learned during the week. The meaning of three hot and a cot.
I had, as someone said, three hot and a cot. Which I've heard in I was doing a talk there in the women's prison there in the Docas, and some woman grew up and said, you have three hot and a cot. You have a breakfast, a lunch and a dinner and a cot to sleep.
Right away, yeah.
But like the sad thing about it is, Oliver, there's a lot of people out there, and when they go to prison, it's a better place for them. Yeah. You know, and I see it when I'm walking in Overstown, I see it when I go in and give talks in the prisons, they're actually happier. And there's people out there getting locked up on purpose. So they have got three hot and a cot. So they're safer in the prison.
That's Ger Redmond speaking with Oliver Callan during the week. He's now a professional triathlete and trainer and fitness guru and motivational speaker. What a man. GerRedmond.com for more. There was consternation during the week with the revelation that the Dart is going to be severely restricted the weekend of the Leinster match in Croke Park. Shock horror on Drive Time.
Lansdowne Road, Sandymount, Sydney Parade, Booterstown, Blackrock, Seapoint, Salt Hill and Monkstown, Doon Leda, Sandy Cove and Glasshool, Glenageary, Dalkey, Killiney and Shankill. My God, Barry, if you wanted to pick a train line and stations that would be most affected if there was a big rugby match on, you couldn't have picked 13 better.
This was a blank weekend till 9 days out. It was the right time to schedule works. We cannot plan essential works, which are about delivering improved DART service. This train protection system is essential for us to have done in time for our new dark fleet.
The message here for an awful lot of people is when they are most needed, public transport services like the DART aren't there.
No, because we're working with Dublin Bus, Go Ahead, Lewis. We'll all be putting on additional capacity. We will have alternative bus services operating as well. We'll advertise those well in advance of this to ensure that everybody who wants to travel by public transport to this game will be able to do so.
But rail closures are nothing new. Many moons ago, the West Clare Railway ceased trading. And some people think it was all down to a certain song by Percy French.
The song killed it. Everyone go on the road and were giving it a boot here and there, everyone you met. And if anything happened, oh, to the West Clare again. Then you might get, if we had more carriages, then we put a second engine on, and the engine that we put on in front of you, him wouldn't be able to give any assistance at all because he'd be in bad repair. There were 14 engines in it all told. And so the engines, the small engines that killed it in the beginning, and he chanced to be travelling when one of them was on it. But he killed it, definitely Percy French killed it.
Just to prove that public transport closures are nothing new, that from Bowman Sunday. Over on Drive Time, they're in holiday mode because they spoke to Gillian Bulger about how to pack for travel.
Check the weather before you go anywhere. Do not panic pack, okay? So panic packing is where you sort of throw everything in the case and cover all, you know, all events and all weathers. Mm. Lay your outfits out on the bed and nothing sort of surplus to requirement is going to make it in.
Methinks that Sarah, however, is a sceptic when it comes to editing the packing.
I mean, it's really good advice, but the problem is recently I went to London with my family and the weather forecast said it was going to be 20 degrees, but I just didn't trust it. So we packed, I insisted that we pack all our coats. So we took one suitcase full of coats and we didn't put them on at all.
Oh, come on, Sarah. You have to trust technology. The app will tell you what the weather is going to be like. If you don't trust it, check a couple of apps. Or better still, follow Cormac's advice.
You put what you need in terms of all of those things in the hand luggage and you layer up in terms of going on the plane. You wear three T-shirts and you wear the jumper as well. You can take them off on the plane. Nobody's going to question you. You wear whatever you want.
So it looks as if the luggage examiners are never going to get their mitts on our Cormac. Over on Clareburne, they were also in a sartorial frame of mind. This time, it's what to iron and what not.
I mean, you hear people talking about ironing jeans or socks or, you know, things that are that you don't need to iron or, you know, like sweatshirts or... I that mystifies me because a good fold can help a lot.
That's Agnes Boucher-Hayes there. And she's got a particular word for the jeans ironing folk.
Pull them. Give them a good tug. Pull them top to bottom and then even out the seams and then fold them. So lay them out flat. Lay the, you know, flatten them out on a table. Fold one side over onto the other. Outside seam of the leg to the outside seam. Put them in and then stack them on top of each other and they come out perfect.
Never again will I inflict an iron on a pair of jeans. Thanks to Agnes Boucher-Hayes on Today with Clare Byrne. Indeed, Clare Byrne's week started with an extended chat with the Taoiseach Simon Harris, who addressed the issue of protest, particularly at public representatives' homes. This was also addressed on Thursday night on The Late Debate.
When you're on the field of play, we all put in the hard knocks, you know, and we put in the tackles and we'll be tough on each other. But when that's over, it should be over.
Sinn Féin TD, Martin Kenny.
Families and people's private life should be separate. And I think in fairness to the vast, vast majority of people, it is. And most people are generous and are humble and are welcoming and are, you know, and all of us in politics understand that and in the media as well. But you come across a very small number of people who have this notion in their heads that they are tougher and better than everybody else and that the best thing to do is to be as ignorant and as hateful and as horrible as they can be and that is a badge of honour. And this seems to be something which is shared on social media then, taking little video clips of how horrible they've been to a politician or to somebody in the media or to whoever it is, a personality somewhere, and that this gives them some kind of kudos in society. We should not have to legislate for people to have a bit of cop on and manners.
Martin Kenny of Sinn Féin drawing a line between the public and the private. A point echoed by Dennis Nocton, Independent TD for Roscommon.
At one of stage during some of the very heated debates that were taking place in relation to Roscommon Hospital, and Michael Finneran was a minister at the time, there was a suggestion from the crowd that we go down and picket outside Michael Finneran's house. And I know I, along with a number of other people, said absolutely no way will we tolerate or accept that. There are plenty of ways for people to express their views. People stop us on the street. People have abused us on the street. We're public representatives. we have to, you know, take the cut and thrust in relation to that. But absolutely, in terms
of... Do you think so? Do you really think you should have to take that?
Well, we have taken it. We do take it. People can be... You know, very emotive.
Well, you have to rise to it.
Yeah, you do. But like, it goes with the job, I'm afraid. That's the reality of it. But in terms of going near someone's home, that is a red line that should never, ever be crossed.
Dennis Nocton, TD, on Thursday night's Late Debate. Arena was a font of information and live music during the week. Paul Muldoon, a biography of Salman Rushdie, and much, much more. But the most interesting bit for me... Do you remember that distinctive Nokia mobile ring? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. All was revealed on Arena.
Which of you has your phone on in studio?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. That piece was written when? Back in the 1900s?
In the 1800s.
You did say to me it's slightly different in the piece in that there's a little, there's a slightly different note.
Yeah, instead of, you have, and then it carries on.
Yeah, so you just that little harmonic note at the end, which is a slightly different
feature. Which I did get told off for on TikTok, because many people like to...
That's not the final note.
Yeah, they were like, no, you did that wrong. And I was like, well, no, because I wanted to do the actual ringtone.
That's Alexandra Whittingham there, educating Sean Rocks and Arena on the intricacies of Tarega, and how that particular tune was appropriated by a certain well-known phone company. To end, some more live music. Two of the nicest jigs I've heard in a long time. McDara O'Fuelon and Pax O'Fuelon. McDara's playing bouzouki, Pax is on the fiddle. The Woods of Quail Rua and Karen's Delight from Cayley House last weekend. Sinead is back next week. From me, Brian Lally, thank you for listening. Good morning. Thank you.